Welcome to Enlightenment Rocks. We're your hosts, Kate Rudy
and Stephanie O'Rourke.
In this podcast, we explore the past, present, and future of Scotland's landscape, and especially the famous rock formations at Glentilt in central Scotland.
Through interviews with artists, historians, and scientists, we chart a path through the unique topography of Scotland from the 18th century to the present day and into our climate's future.
Right, are you guys recording?
Yep.
All right, shall we have a listen to 600 million year old CO2 being released?
Okay, did you guys get that?
Yes, we did.
So often when I'm walking in places like Glentilt, my mind isn't really focused on the landscape. Instead, if you're anything like me, you're often thinking about when to pause for a snack or whether your dog is about to run off. And as a result, it's easy to overlook some of the features of the landscape that have so much to say about the Earth's history, about how it came to take its current shape. Today, I'm speaking to two Earth scientists from the University of St. Andrews, who will talk about how we can look more closely at Glentilt and the Scottish landscape in general, and what it can tell us. In the 18th century, naturalists famously referred to rock formations as the archives of nature. So as a kind of historical document, really. And today, we'll be talking about what that means in the present. To get us started, could each of you introduce yourself and tell us a bit about what you currently research?
Okay, so hi, I'm James Ray, and my research melds geology and climate science. So I look at the history of our planet's climate. I try and understand times like the Ice Ages or the climates of the dinosaurs when climate was really very different on Earth. And I use that to try and better understand how the climate system works and better understand what we have in our future.
Yeah, and hi, I'm Tony Prave. James and I are colleagues here at St. Andrews. And I describe myself very simply as a geologist, a person that studies the Earth. And if I had to put a more sexy term on it, I'd say I'm an Earth historian, because my interest is going a bit deeper in time than even James does, and look at how our planet has evolved to the state it is in currently from when it began 4.5 billion years ago. And the record that we have of that evolutionary trajectory is the sedimentary rock record, which is what I enjoy thinking about and trying to understand better.
To bring us to Glentilt, can you tell us about how it would have formed in the first place?
The answer, in a sense, is that you have to have something that can scrape away rock and mud to create something like a glen in the landscape. And the two things that primarily do that are rivers and ice, or rivers of ice, if you like. And Glentilt is the result of both of those processes. So most of Scotland's landscape, as we see it today, is the result of multiple ice ages over the last several million years. But those rivers of ice occupied valleys that had previously been occupied by rivers. And so as climate slowly cooled over a timescale of about 4 million years, we start to see the formation of big ice sheets in Scotland, of glaciers starting to go down those river valleys. And eventually the power of those enormous tongues of ice kind of bulldozed aside everything that kind of stood in their path. And so that is what you see, this kind of bulldozed track of a glacier, which has a very characteristic U shape to it. So kind of straight, steep sides and quite a flat valley floor.
A person you'll probably hear us talking quite a bit about today is a Scotsman, James Hutton. And James Hutton was part of that fabulous group of people, the Scottish Enlightenment in the late 1700s, that really transformed our society. Everything from the steam engine to philosophy to an understanding of chemistry. And Hutton was part of that group. And his great insights form the foundation for our science today. And one of the things that is fascinating is that Hutton thought about the Earth operating in terms of cycles. He had what he termed the cycle of rejuvenation and the cycle of decay. And this was the creation of landscapes and the destruction of landscapes. Many of these aspects are what can be seen in Scotland.
One of the reasons we're especially interested in Glen Tilt is the discoveries it prompted for James Hutton over 200 years ago. Can you describe what it was that he observed in Glen Tilt and what it would look like to us today?
To think about what Hutton saw and basically what we would observe in the present day if we walk through Glen Tilt, I want to put it into the context of what Hutton was trying to do at the time. And at the time of Hutton, this is the Scottish Enlightenment, the mid-late 1700s, there was a great debate about how rocks formed on Earth. And a major influence of how people thought about the rock record was this idea that rocks precipitated from primordial oceans, that they, just like salt does today, and the idea was that granite, which is this hard rock that usually you see at the bases of mountains, it had to precipitate and form first. And then the sedimentary rocks that are a little bit softer, we see these today, they're nicely layered. The rocks that you drive around Scotland, when you see them, they look like layer cakes. They form second. And then we have this final dirt, the soil forming on top. Well, Hutton felt that that was incorrect. And he felt it was incorrect because he was trying to understand how Earth's landscape formed. And he was going around and recognizing that these various rocks that people thought formed in the primordial ocean first, things like granites, were actually intruding into these so-called secondary rocks, which meant that they had to be younger than these so-called secondary rocks. And the only image that I could think of to give you in terms of without having a visual aspect in front of us, is if you think about holding up your hand with your fingers spread out in front of you, and underneath your hand is a layered cake, and you stick your hand forcefully up through the layers of that cake, that is what Hutton saw in Glen Tilt. His fingers are the granite, the main body of the granite would be the palm of your hand, and the fingers as they penetrated through the layers of the cake, penetrated through these metamorphic schistous rocks. And that was his prima facie evidence that showed for the very first time that granite intrudes into rocks and therefore is younger, and it completely falsified what was the through-going theory at the time called Neptunism.
And I guess just to add to that, if you are walking up Glen Tilt or you know somewhere else in Scotland and are looking for an example of what that really might look like on the ground, Tony's analogy of the cake and the fingers is perfect. The granite often will be of a kind of pinkish color, have quite big crystals in it. So you might see some kind of pink or white shiny crystals in that kind of generally white or pink rock. And then it's intruding, in this case, into something that is a cake-like sediment that have been cooked a bit. So we call those metasediments. So they've been metamorphosed, and that tends to create some different kinds of minerals in them. And in this case, we're thinking about schists. These are kind of beautifully shiny. They've got lots of micas in them that are glinting. They catch the eye, but you maintain some of that original sedimentary layering. You get kind of extra layering on top of that from these beautiful micas in the rocks. So you've got this layered kind of silver-colored, kind of like a cake made of, I don't know, salmon scales or something. That's just the most disgusting sounding cake I can possibly imagine. You know, that's the right kind of color and glint to it. And then you've got your pink fingers of granite going through your salmon scale cake. Sorry for that horrible image.
Hutton was a fascinating person because at the time of the Scottish Enlightenment, he had friends who were doing great things. Like I said, Joseph Black, the discoverer of carbon dioxide, this gas that we're now so concerned with today. He was friends with many, many different types of people that did things like thermodynamics. And so his concept was that he wanted to make a contribution in terms of thinking about our planet. And Hutton was concerned with was processes that he thought were being repeated through time. He had something that was called the paradox of the soil. James made a comment earlier of explaining how a glen formed, but Hutton was a farmer, and he would go out during a rainstorm and see soil being washed off of the landscape. And he thought, this is strange because soil has always been with us throughout time, throughout written human history. We've always had soil, but yet whenever it rains, it gets washed off the land. This was the paradox of the soil in Hutton's mind. And he thought, well, if it's continually being eroded away, it must be continually being made. And so he wanted to find aspects where we could see these processes happening continuously. And he went to the rock record. And so for Hutton, one of the aspects that he did was to recognize that Earth surface processes were a continuum, that they had no beginning, as far as his mind, and they had no end. Remember, this was at a time when nobody knew how old the Earth was. And he finished his great work, The Theory of the Earth, in 1788, with a sentence that is repeated to Earth science students for the last 200 years, "No vestige of a beginning, no prospect of an end." It was cycles of processes occurring time and time again. And Hutton is considered the father of deep time. That is, when I'm able to say I'm an Earth historian, talking about the Earth being 1 billion, 2 billion, 3 billion, 4 billion years old, this we can tie directly to Hutton's thinking.
Well, how could someone today see evidence of cyclical recurring processes in the Scottish landscape?
Hutton was deeply concerned to try and find observational evidence of this idea of cycles occurring through geological history, through Earth history. And he scoured the Scottish landscape to try and find these, and he did. He actually found three of these examples that allowed him to understand that there was this continual creation of soil and its continual erosion off Earth's surface. And he did this on the Isle of Arran, he did this at Jedburgh, but perhaps the most famous locality he did this at was at Sicker Point in the Scottish borders, just north of the border with England on the east coast of Scotland. And there, what you see very strikingly are two sets of layered rocks. One set of layered rocks is tilted vertical, like a deck of cards standing on end. On top of that deck of cards standing on end is another set of sedimentary rocks, but they are horizontal, like a deck of cards that are sitting horizontally. And you could think of it in your mind as almost looking like a T junction. And what Hutton realized is lower vertically standing sedimentary rocks must have started out horizontally. If you go to a beach today, the sand on the beach is in horizontal layers. They're not standing vertically. So Hutton realized that those layers that were vertical must have started out horizontally. They must have been made into a rock. Those rocks must have been tilted. Those rocks then must have been eroded to allow the next horizontal layer of sediments sitting on top of them. And then those sediments had to be turned into rock. So all of a sudden now we see in one outcrop that you could stand that is the size of a small room, this evidence for cyclical patterns occurring through time. And this was then Hutton's prima facie evidence, as I've said before, for recognizing that Earth's processes were operating in cycles through time. No vestige of a beginning, no prospect of an end.
As we walk through Glentilt, but also through the Scottish landscape in general, where could we see evidence that the shape of the Earth continues to change today?
To answer your question, Stephanie, about how we can see the landscape changing today, or are there processes that affect the landscape in terms of how it's modified under processes that are occurring today? And one of the things that I would challenge anybody to do is if they could walk out and say they see soil forming, because nobody sees soil forming. That is a process that takes tens, hundreds, sometimes thousands, even sometimes in some instances, tens of thousands of years. However, all of us can walk out during an extreme rainstorm and see soil being washed out in rivers and turning rivers brown and dirty and muddy, and even going into where they enter the sea. I can stand it where I live and look at the Tay Estuary in a big rainstorm and just see it turning brown. So this is showing us that these processes that sculpt Earth's land surface operate at different rates. Some operate at a rate in which we can see them happen within an hour. Some take hundreds of thousands of years.
So let's now think about how our landscape might evolve in the future, and in particular, how it's going to evolve in a changing climate. So the last million years or more of Scottish landscape history has been defined by these kind of pulsating cycles of ice coursing down our glens and bulldozing aside everything in its path to make these enormous U-shaped valleys. And the really fundamental thing that we've done by elevating CO2 is we've stopped that happening. So we have staved off the dawn of the next ice age, potentially indefinitely. Now, what else might happen to our landscape in an altered climate? I think the big one for me is kind of accessed again by looking into the geological record. And so this is what I do in my own line of research, look at how CO2 has changed through time, and then look at the climates associated with those CO2 levels to work out where we might head in the future. So today, CO2 has risen from its pre-industrial level of 280. So for context, during those ice ages, we had 200 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. That's take a million molecules in the atmosphere and 200 of them would be carbon dioxide. And at the end of the ice age, that rose by 80 parts per million to reach a level of 280. And that was enough to melt back the massive ice sheets covering Scotland and much of North America. Now, what we've done in the last 100 years is we've done more than the same again in terms of CO2 rise. So we've gone from 280 all the way up to 414, speaking today in 2021. So what does a world with 414 ppm CO2 look like? Well, to figure that out, we have to go deep into the geological past. In fact, we have to go 4 million years ago. This is a time before the dawn of our species or even our genus. And it's a time that looks really fundamentally different to how Earth's surface looks today, in particular in terms of its ice sheets. So at 414 ppm, 4 million years ago, we have no ice on Greenland, no ice on West Antarctica. And in fact, enough ice has melted off Antarctica that it's covered in a forest of beech trees. You can find those fossilized beech trees on the Antarctic Peninsula. And as a result of all of that ice melting and flowing off the continents into the ocean, sea level was about 20 meters higher than it is today. Now, thankfully, ice takes a bit of time to melt. But we are currently really in a race against time to see if we can get CO2 back out of the atmosphere to prevent Earth's ice sheets catching up with a level of 414 ppm. Because the geological record shows us very clearly where we are headed with this elevated CO2 in the atmosphere. It's melting back all of that Greenland ice and a chunk of ice on West Antarctica, elevating sea level by 20 meters. That would, of course, displace comfortably a billion people around our planet and right here fundamentally alter the Scottish coastline.
Can you speak a little bit about how CO2 levels in particular will change the Scottish environment?
Well, the amazing thing about CO2 is it's really the primary control on Earth's climate. And so if we keep elevating CO2 in the future, let's have a think about what that causes the planet to look like. And again, we can access this by thinking about times in the past where CO2 was much higher. And if we want to find a time in the past where CO2 was really a lot higher, we can look to a time called the Eocene. It's about 50 million years ago. And by that point, CO2 was around 1,000 parts per million in the atmosphere. We had, at that time, this kind of super greenhouse climate with no ice really anywhere on the planet. And in fact, with a climate that was different enough that you have crocodiles and alligators, cold-blooded creatures, living at high latitudes. I mean, it's just, to us, really an unimaginably different planet, but one that you can see written down in the rocks at Earth's surface. So, you know, how do we know this? Well, there are lots of different ways we can tell how climate has changed, but a pretty striking one is if you go up to some of these Arctic islands, I think it was Ellesmere Island that they found this whole fossil crocodile skeleton on. And that is a surefire sign of a different climate, because crocodiles freeze if it gets below zero. And in fact, we know the temperature limits of crocodiles and alligators really quite well. Biologists, kind of sadistic people back in the 50s, used to put crocodiles and alligators into fridges and freezers just to kind of check. Yep. Cold-blooded creatures, they do indeed freeze when it gets down to freezing. So we are really at those elevated CO2 levels of 1,000 parts per million, looking at a complete transformation of our planet. And this isn't something that is completely out of reach. If we continue to burn and kind of grow our burning of fossil fuels at the rate that we have been doing, those CO2 levels are entirely possible to us. I mean, I think the amazing thing about the CO2 and climate crisis is our agency in it. We can send climate back to the Eocene. Like, we won't get there overnight. We won't have, of course, you know, crocodiles would take their time to get up to Scotland or the high Arctic. That's not going to happen instantaneously. But we can achieve those CO2 levels with the burning of coal and oil. That is entirely within reach. But more optimistically, we also have the technology available to us now that we don't have to take that path into the future. We know what we need to do to reduce CO2 levels. And again, you can see it as you go around the Scottish landscape. You can see the amazing success of the Scottish renewables industry, our wind turbines, which now produce enough electricity that they can cover the electricity demands of all of Scotland. So we do know how to fix this and avoid those really prehistoric climates in the future.
What James was just saying there is something that I, as a geologist, think about all the time, because he talked about deep time going back 4 million years, but I often go back 400 million years, sometimes even 1 to 2 billion years in terms of looking at rocks. And one of the criticisms that I face as a geologist when I meet people and we talk about climate change, somebody just says, as James pointed out, climate is always changing. And yes, it is. But what I'd like to draw your thoughts back to was thinking about soil formation. And I challenged anybody to see soils forming. We can see them being washed away in an instant, but we don't see soils forming. And yes, nature and our planet does regulate climate. Climate does change naturally without people, but it is at a rate that is very, 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 very slow. Now, I have in front of me a rock called a limestone. That limestone is 600 million years old. Earth's processes, the ones that Hutton looked at, where rock was being eroded, when we do this, erosion requires rain. Rain is water and carbon dioxide joined together. That rain falls on a rock and erodes it. It creates a soil. In doing that, it can often lock up the CO2 molecule in the rock. And this limestone is made of ancient 600 million year old CO2 atmosphere. Gas became a rock because of weathering, the kind of things that Hutton did. And I will put a little drop of hydrochloric acid on this rock, and you will hear it bubbling, just like if you open up a can of Coke or your favorite lager, the CO2 is released. In this instance, when the drop of acid goes on, the CO2 is not coming out of a can of Coke or a can of lager, but this 600 million year old rock releasing 600 million year old CO2. And that CO2 was captured and held in that rock until we released it. And now it's back in the atmosphere, contributing to global warming.
In closing, I just want to ask, what's special about the Scottish landscape from your perspective?
An aspect of Scotland that attracts almost all people here is this visually aesthetic landscape. And to me, I have been lucky enough as a geologist to work in many places all over the world, but one of the most iconic and visually inspiring landscapes is what you have in the Northwest Highlands of Scotland. And as a geologist, we, like you, we see the mountains, we see the valleys, we see the glens that James explained a little bit ago how they formed. But for me, I also see what I like to call a timescape, because our landscapes are formed by the rocks that underlie them. And those rocks formed at a particular time in Earth's past. And for me, when I look at a landscape, I actually see what the Earth looked like at a particular time in the past, because I know what the age of those rocks are. For example, one of the reasons that I love the Northwest Highlands is that you can walk around on those land surfaces, and James was explaining how glaciers shaped so much of what we see in Scotland today. But if you walk around in the extreme Northwest Highlands, that land surface that you're walking on is over a billion years old. The ice has re-sculpted what was an ancient landscape. So for me, I can stand and look at the Earth, and what I see is what the Earth looked like a billion years ago. And to me, that is the beauty of Scotland. It's, for the size of the country, has the most diverse geology of any place on the planet. And so it's just a wonderful, wonderful thing to be able to link together a beautiful topography, a beautiful landscape, with a beautiful record of Earth history.
As I walk through the Scottish landscape again, I just get so much more out of it, I think, as an earth scientist. I mean, Scotland's landscape is like walking through the pages of a geology textbook. You can go from the very first chapter with the formation of the ancient rocks in pools of magma deep beneath our feet. You can see those kinds of rocks, you can see the products of their erosion, and you can see the repeated sculpting of them by the pulsating of glaciers. And tied into that, you can see the history of Earth's climate too. So every time those glaciers coursed down our glens, we had low CO2 levels, and rising CO2 caused that ice to melt back. So you can see this this kind of cyclic change in Earth's climate. You can see the power of CO2 to alter climate. And I think that also helps you grasp the impact that CO2 can have on Scotland's and the world's climate and landscape going forward into the future.
James and Tony, thank you so much for joining us. I can't wait to get back out there and start exploring.
This podcast was made possible by the Knowledge Exchange and Impact Fund at the University of St. Andrews. The hosts are Kate Rudy and Stephanie O'Rourke. This series was mostly recorded online because of the pandemic, with some live recording by John Michael Kennedy. Sound production is by Eggbox Audio. The editor was Zoe Irvin, and the assistant editor, Molly Fredrickson. Music composed, played, and recorded by Elizabeth Flett, with thanks to Colin McAndrew, Barry Stewart, Al McGowan, and the Royal Society of Edinburgh.